I'm on the road to recovery, step by step.
Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. Spencer, let's have our joke now.
Hey, Spencer, alcoholic joke teller. I got another one from Take Me to Your Sponsor, Best Jokes and Cartoons from AA Grapevine. Three retirees, each with hearing loss, were playing golf one beautiful day. One guy remarked to the other, "Windy, isn't it?" "No," the second man replied, "it's Thursday." The third man chimed in and said, "So am I, let's go have a beer."
I'm a recovered alcoholic and my name is Zach. And I'd like Don to come up and read our secretary's report.
Hey, my name is Don, and I am your recovered alcoholic secretary. Hey, good evening, guys. Now, every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, so the baskets are going around now. Keeping with the seventh tradition, let's start 2025 off right with some good contributions to the meeting. This is a good meeting. I've asked Christine to read the recovered statement. Now, we read this notice to explain why many people in AA identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic. Christine.
Hi, I'm Christine. I'm an alcoholic. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If you were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for a lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. Page 23. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Thanks, Christine. All right, let's keep on rolling. 1940 style big book sponsorship from forward to the second edition. Alcoholics Anonymous, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober. at once and remain that way. Thank you. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen felt come to believe and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 25% success rate, which is pretty impressive if you're asking me. Now, I'm going to ask a very important question. Is anyone in the house looking for a sponsor tonight? Raise your hand. All right, we've got two people here. Let me ask another question. Who in the house has a working knowledge of the 12th step and is looking to sponsor someone? All right, so guys, those who are looking for sponsors, you have a buffet of potential sponsors in the house tonight. So what we suggest is hang up by the piano after the meeting and someone will find you and the dance of recovery will begin. So cool beans. Now let's do some announcements. Now, Broward County Intergroup, card here, is where you can buy AA-related literature and medallions, and Intergroup is also responsible for creating our when and where and scheduling the AA hotline. Stop by and visit them. Next slide, Mike. Now, BCIC, the committee here, is responsible for bringing meetings into places where people like us can't get out, such as jails, detoxes, rehabs, and the like. Now, they meet monthly to organize a meeting schedule at the 12-step house. Do we? Anyone in the house, a member of BCIC, raise your hand. Oh, we got two people here tonight. Good stuff, guys, good stuff. Now, if anyone's interested in getting involved with BCICS, I would suggest you talk to Catherine and you talk to Tommy. They'll get you hooked up. Next slide, Mike. We have some volunteer opportunities. AA's Got Talent. The planning meeting will be held, I believe, this Sunday, if I have my days right, at 12:30 p.m. At the 441 Village Plaza in Margate. No spots left for performers. Wow. That's pretty much going to be a nice show, man. We have some volunteer opportunities. I don't know about that. Tom M. is here from January 2nd to February 6th, the man from Arizona. Join us on Monday. We have a big book study where we dissect the big book line by line. We just started with How It Works, I believe, or
more.
Sorry, Mike. Thank you for correcting me. And so we're in the beginning of the big book. So those who are interested in getting a new perspective on the big book, we suggest you join us 7:15. And it's now on Zoom. What else? I believe that's it. Now we have CDs, mugs, large print big books, little red books, and big book dictionaries for sale. We meet every Thursday, starting promptly at 7:15. We ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the Road to Recovery tune. Enjoy the next meeting, guys.
Thank you, Don. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation, so please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that might make noise that will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everybody ready? Yeah? All right, let's start the meditation. All right, I'm going to lead the fog light prayer. If you'd like to follow along, it's on the screen here. God, amen. There is a solution from the big book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. And I've asked my friend Jeff to read Appendix 2, The Spiritual Experience.
All right, good evening, everyone. Jeff, alcoholic. The spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of a sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feelings and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what psychologist William James calls the educational variety because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends and the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Thank you, Jeff. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so just set your phones to airplane slash meeting mode, or just turn it off. And it's time to introduce the speaker. I got to meet Tom for the first time tonight. I'm really excited to hear what he has to say. And I did find out that even though it was brief, he spent some time with my late great sponsor from Jacksonville, Jim P. So let's all welcome Tom.
Good evening. Good evening, everybody. How's everybody tonight? I can't see very well. That's why I got this hat on, because it light, you know, hits me in the eyes, and then I can't see too well. And I like to look in your eyes. You know, there's a connection that gets made when I'm speaking, and I look at you. You know, this drunk was walking alongside a cliff, up real high, and he was stumbling all around, you know. It's like the therapist asked me, you know, did alcoholics run in your family? And I said, no, they stumbled around and broke a lot of stuff. But this guy was stumbling around up on this cliff, and he took a tumble and fell over the side, and he was shooting straight down, and there was nothing. He reached out. There was a limb. That's the only thing that was on the side of that cliff about halfway down. He grabbed and he held on to that limb, and he looked up above him, and he couldn't see any way of climbing up, and he looked down below, and he couldn't see any way of getting down. And he looked up into the sky, and he said, is there anybody up there? And a voice came down from above and said, I'm up here. And he said, will you help me? And the voice said, yeah, let go of the limb. And he looked back up in the sky, and he said, is there anybody else up there? So, you know, we're going to talk about the second and the third step tonight. Of course, that's my story. You know, I have a friend from Philly. He always talks about, you know, I can't, you know, I'm not real good at quoting, but you know, there's a line in the big book, right, that goes, I mean, you know, you can go on to die from a terrible alcoholic death, or you can accept a spiritual way of life. And then he always says, let me get back to you on that. Right? I was talking to a sponsee on the way here tonight. Telling that to him, you know. Because like me, for those who weren't here last week, I didn't have an easy time with coming to surrender. It took the pain of my alcoholism for me to surrender. You know, it's really the pain comes from the resistance to change, resisting that change. I didn't want to change. I want to do things my way. You know, I'm, like I was talking about last week, was wonderful with compliance, but not very good with surrender. You know, I was great when it came to complying with the law and with my folks and with getting my stuff back. And, you know, I was really good at complying. But once I seemed to have everything fixed, you know, I was running my life. You know, I'm one of those who believe that my life's manageable as long as I don't drink. That all I have to do is just not drink. That my only problem is picking up a drink. And if I don't pick up a drink, case closed. I really didn't see any need for the rest of these steps. I didn't see any need for a sponsor. I didn't see any need for prayer. I didn't see any need for reading literature. I had this figured out when I showed up at the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, 50 years ago at 21. Drinking since I was 13. Having trouble my whole life. Never fitting in. You know, we were reading in my home group the other night a guy's story. And in that story that we were reading, he talked about how he could remember when he was a child on the playground, and he was all alone. Man, I identify with that. That's the same memory I had. First grade, St. Agnes School in Springfield, Illinois, where I was born, raised. Being on the playground and always feeling like I didn't belong. I didn't belong. I didn't know what this was. You know, I come to know from Alcoholics Anonymous what this was. That this is this restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. That this is, you know, what a good friend of mine always talked about all the time. You know, I don't think much of myself, but I'm all I think about. You know, I became introduced to a man who got sober when I was born in 1952. Died in 1997 with 45 years from Los Angeles. And he used to say, I don't know who you think about all day, but I know who I think about. I think about me. I wake up thinking about me, and I go to bed at night thinking about me. And the only time I think about you is how it relates to me. Now, if you can identify with these things, maybe you have this thing that I have. This alcoholism. Now, and when we ended up last week with me spending 10 years around AA, I used to say that I was in and out of AA for 10 years. And I realized many years ago, you were never in AA in those years. You were just around AA. You know, there's a big difference between being around AA and being in AA. You know, being around looks like this. I come to meetings and I hang around and think all I have to do is just not drink. That's being around AA. Being in Alcoholics Anonymous is a different thing. First of all, I had a big problem with God. You know, that problem, that goes all the way back into my childhood. You know, because I never really was comfortable with being taught things that I didn't want to learn. And I wasn't interested in what the nuns had to teach me. And the way I was raised, you know, and you won't hear me, you will not hear me say that I'm a recovering Catholic, okay? You're not going to hear that out of me. Because the book that keeps me sober says to see where religious people are right, not where they're wrong. And what I was really good at was looking at what was wrong. I was always really good at looking at everything that was wrong that I didn't agree with, at focusing on that, at focusing on what would help me to have a resentment. You know, I can remember many years ago in my years of being around AA, when I first used to hang around the 101 Club on Dixie Highway, and there used to be a little place up the road from there called the Fifth Chapter. And I went in there into a midnight meeting one time, and a man was sharing, and he was talking about how he couldn't afford to feel justifiable anger. And I thought to myself, what's wrong with him? What is he, a sissy or something? He can't afford to feel justifiable anger? What's that supposed to mean? You know, I took resentment towards that. Because, you know, that's what I was about. I was all about justifiable anger. You know, I ate and breathed and loved being angry. And I was always angry. I can't remember a time in my childhood when I wasn't angry. I was always angry about something or angry at somebody. I didn't play well with other children. I didn't like competitive sports because I didn't like you being competitive with me. If you laughed, if I struck out a bat, I might throw the bat at you. You know, I did not get along well with anybody who tried to push me or mess with me. And I didn't like the nuns messing with me. From the time I was in the second grade, I had a nun who used to grab me by my ears, you know, and shake my head violently. And by the time the Christian Brothers were done with me in high school, they were using their knuckles on me. I was never comfortable with being with people that played sports. I wasn't comfortable with the people that were good at school work. And by the time I got into the second half of the second time, I was in the fifth grade. I flunked the first time. second time through the fifth grade, I found a gang to run with. A bunch of little hoodlums, okay? And they were who I was comfortable with. That was my crowd. The crowd, you know, that was angry at everybody and everything. You know, the guys that carried switchblades and tore up the seats in the theater, stabbed people's tires, wrecked things, got in fights with everybody, made brass knuckles out of muffler clamps, things like that, you know. And so this resentment that I had towards God, it grew. It grew, you know, because, you know, I always liked the line, you know, glass in hand, I warp my mind. And my mind became warped from drugs and alcohol, you know, and it fed all that negativity that was in me. Now, finally, you know, if people that were here last week heard me say that what it took for me to finally surrender was the alcoholism, the progression of my alcoholism had finally taken me to the place where I no longer could stop anymore. See, I always stopped, you know. I got here the first time because, you know, I heard a bunch of kids in an automobile accident. And I got the idea that it would be good to hang around AA because it would be look good to the judge. And he'd give me a break, and he did. I said that when I was talking about the first step last week. He gave me a break, and so, you know, I learned my break worked. And I'm real good at working things because I'm a very clever, smart, thinking person who knows how to get himself out of whatever he gets himself into. And I kept using that. But the problem was that alcoholism has a trick for you if you don't die from it. It's called progression. And the progression took me to the place where I no longer could stop anymore. Didn't matter how much trouble I was in. I shared this last week and how I'm sitting in a jail cell again, trying to figure out why I have all these problems, why my life's always been a problem, why can't I stay sober? And the thought came into my head, there was a voice that wasn't mine that said, because you're crazy. And the reason you're crazy is because you think you can run your life, but you can't. But you believe that you can, and that's why you're insane. And for the first time in all the years around AA, I thought to myself, that's the truth. That's the truth about me. And, you know, my mother, one of my great enablers, my mother almost loved me to death, me and my sister, who's sober about 9 more months than me. I just celebrated 41 years in December. And the reason she's got 9 more months than me, because I took her to her first meeting, then I went and got drunk. But she needed to go to that meeting, you know. And anyway, my mother about loved both of us to death, you know. And my mother was a nice woman. She was a very nice woman and from a nice family. But I drank in the worst places in town. She'd come down looking for me in Skid Row places and get me out of there and take me home. And I would get sober me up, and I'd cry and carry on about how I was never going to do that again. And then as soon as things got fixed and things got good, why, I was gone. Gone again. And she said, I, you know, can't take any more of you. You're going to the VA hospital in Tampa. I went over there, and I had attempted burglary charges on me, so I was willing to go. Because, you know, I'm a great thinker. And I'm figuring, you know, hey, if I'm in a federal facility, maybe they'll leave me alone. Which they did. That worked, you know. But I get there, and they say, oh, well, we have a 6-week waiting list. You know, you're going to have to put your name on the list and come back in 6 weeks. And I'm thinking, well, by then I might be in prison. By then I says, I want to see the psychiatrist. Well, what for? And I said, that's my business. See, because I'm a great thinker. I know what to say to the psychiatrist, right? A couple of nights ago, I tried to grease myself. Oh, call right up to the AA ward, says, I got a guy, I want him there at 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm sending him up there. You and your mother stay over here in Tampa, don't go back home, you'll be here at 6 o'clock in the morning. So me and Mom are looking for a motel, and of course I see one across from a bar, and I say, there's a motel there, Ma, you know. Let's wait for her to go to sleep, then rob her purse. It's a good thing she didn't have too much money. I'd have gone in a blackout. Who knows where I would have come out, you know. Well, that was the last time I was drunk. December the 8th, 1983. Next morning's my anniversary date, December the 9th, 1983, when I went in the VA. And things were starting to change for me. You know, I have now this knowledge that not only am I powerless over alcohol and drugs and whatever it is I use to treat my alcoholism with, because that's all the substances are. They're just something I use as a treatment for the disease of my alcoholism. Alcohol didn't make me an alcoholic. Drugs didn't make me a drug addict. That's what I use to treat my alcoholism. And so I'm in there, and I'm crazier than a hoot owl. And I love to tell this story. There's this guy comes in, and it's about 35-man therapeutic community. And we elect our own officers, right? Well, see, I'm so smart about Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been around 10 years. I know all about it, so they elected me to president. You know, and I'm sitting around every night, you know, until 1 o'clock in the morning talking to guys about what they need to do to get sober. And we have guys that would work nights there. We call them the ward boys. They're orderlies who work, you know, putting guys in restraints and, you know, do the muscle work. And they're sober veterans, and they asked to work in the AA ward, you know, and they're the babysitters at night. And so one night I'm walking down the hallway, and two of them are walking my way, and they grab me, one by each arm, and they open this door, shove me in this room, and they shove me down in a chair, and one of them gets over me and says, you know what, Tom, we don't need any more counselors here, okay? We got enough counselors. And you need to start talking about yourself and stop talking to everybody else about what they need to do. Because this is how you've been staying sick and keeping from looking at your own stuff. And like I said, I was a very angry person. You know, I was a very aggressive, obnoxious, loudmouth, arrogant alcoholic who had jumped down your throat with both boots to prove you were wrong and I was right, because all that mattered to me was that I was right. For years around Alcoholics Anonymous, I would argue with all the old timers in AA, and they'd pat me on the back and they'd say, that's okay, Tom, you got a right to be wrong. And I used to think, what's that supposed to mean? I got a right to be wrong. I couldn't understand that, because deep down in me, I didn't believe that I had a right to be wrong. You had to be right, wrong, and I had to be right. You know, that's all fed that justifiable anger of mine. And I spent 2 months in there on Anna abuse, and I learned a lot of things about myself. I was sharing an experience with this sponsee on the phone on the way down here, you know, who's had a lot of trouble, and he just got out of 72 days. And I told him, I said, yeah, you know, I was always running back to AA because I was afraid I was going to die. I was afraid I was going to catch prison finally, because I've been in and out of county jails for years and the stockade, you know. And I'm afraid that I'm gonna die, you know. And then I'm sitting here in this hospital in December, and I've been around AA 10 years. I'm 31 now, and I'm a Vietnam era veteran. And there's guys that are World War II era veterans, and guys that are Korean War era veterans. And they're all sitting around, and I'm listening to them talk. And I've been around AA 10 years. They've been around 20, 25, 30, talking about how they get off of the streets up in Philly and Chicago and New York and come to Tampa to the VA every winter like it's a resort. And a thought hits me. These guys aren't dead. They're sitting at the same table I'm sitting at. And I'm not going to die. I'm just going to keep living this stinking miserable life of an alcoholic over and over again. Yeah, I might do hard time. A lot of them have done hard time. And I made up my mind right then that I want a new way of life. See, because being afraid never kept me sober. Because sooner or later, you ain't afraid no more. I really believe, you know, that I'm still standing here in front of you today because of that desire to have a new life. And the willingness to do whatever it took. And I came out of that VA, and I went to go back, you know, I'm a Central House guy from Delray Beach. And I went to go back to the old Central House. In those days was the American Legion. I've been in every Central House since the beginning. I always tell them this when I'm speaking at Central House. They love to hear this story. You know, there's been four Central Houses. The first one was on the northbound side of Federal Highway where Anthony's is now. That was Howard Johnson. And then across the street, it was just a little storefront. 1975, this old man named Tex that used to tell me at the 101 Club, I'm your sponsor. And I used to think, I'll be a nice guy and let the old guy think that, you know. And I kind of like Tex anyway because he'd been in San Quentin. He'd been in Folsom. He used to ride the rails, you know. We used to go to the old 12-step house when it was over here on Las Olas, when Las Olas was not a nice neighborhood. And I like Tex. Tex said, I'm going up to Delray to speak this Saturday to the Central House. You want to go with me? And I said, yes, I'd never been to the Central House. I'd never been to Delray Beach. I said, okay. So we went up there, and in those days, there used to be about 30, 40 people in the Central House in those days, you know, a couple, three meetings a week maybe. And after we were done, he said, okay, we're going to go do some 12-step work. And I says, okay. So we go over, and on the north side of the Central House of the American Legion, there's a little house there. That house is still there, I think. Three-room house, three-bedroom house, and in those days, that was South County Mental Health. That house was the detox. And there was three beds in there with restraints because they used to put the alkies in restraints to go through the DTs. And Tex goes in and he sits down with the big book and he pulls a big book out and he starts reading to this guy who's in full DTs out of the big book, talking out of his mind. And I'm thinking, this Tex is a fool. What good is this? This guy doesn't even know we're here. And I can hardly wait till we get out so I can tell Tex about himself. And we get outside and I say to Tex, I say, man, what good did that do? I said, that guy didn't even know we were here. And Tex looked at me and he says, well, we're not here for that guy. And I said, well, who are we here for? He said, we're here for you. I was the one being 12-stepped, okay? But you can understand when you have a mind like mine. When you have a mind like mine that thinks like my mind thinks, you know. Let me tell you, when the book says Defiance is my outstanding characteristic. You can count on what I'm telling you. Because I've been defiant my whole life. At war with everybody and everything. You know, I got guys that are sitting up here that are my guys, they'll tell you they know me years and years. I ran the laborers union here for almost 30 years. You think I ran the laborers union because I was a nice guy? No, it was because I was mean. Of course, I was 5 years sober, but the time I finally got there, or I would have never got there, I would have got thrown out of a window, according to Papa Joe. So that's what he told me. I'm going to have you thrown out a window if you don't stop drinking. I didn't know he was. I thought it was because he cared about me, but really he was more worried about because a buddy of mine told him, said, Joe, you got to do something about Tommy's drinking because he gets drunk and tells people the stuff we're doing. And Joe's son and son-in-law were already in the penitentiary for racketeering, you know. He wanted to make sure he didn't go. So, you know, when I get out of there, I go back to the old central house. And as I go to walk into the front door, this man is standing in the doorway. You had, you know, double doors, and you had a double screen doors, and one screen door was always locked, and the other screen door you could go in and out. And this man stood right in the threshold in the doorway. And as I approach to walk up to the door, he doesn't move out of my way. He stands there, and he stares at me. And I'm thinking, who is this joker? And I go, hey, man. What's the deal? And he looks at me and says, where are you going? And I says, I'm going to the meeting. He says, you don't want to get sober. And I'm thinking, who is this guy? What's he talking about? I says, I've been sober 2 months. He said, yeah, I heard up the VA on antabuse. That's easy. What are you going to do now? And I think, man, I don't even know this guy. What's this guy? Who's this guy to be talking to me like this? Right? I said, what do you mean? What am I going to do now? What do you want me to do? In my sarcastic, nasty way. He says to me, all I want you to do is what I've been trying to tell you for years to do. And I'm thinking, this guy's nuts. I don't even know this guy. You know, what's he talking about? Trying to tell me for years to do. And I says, yeah, well, what's that? And he said, get on your knees and ask God for the strength to stay clean and sober. And I look at him and I say, I don't see how that's going to do any good. And then he says to me, he goes, how's your way been working, wise guy? How's your way been working for you? When you got a track record like mine, what are you going to say? Are you going to tell him just fine? No, you're going to say the same thing I said. And I'm so egotistical, I couldn't even say you're right. All I could say was, I guess you're right. And then he told me the best thing I was ever told in AA. He said, well then, I guess what you believe in doesn't make any difference then, does it? Because what you believe in doesn't work, right? I said, yeah, I guess you're right. And he said, well, you know what? I'm not asking you what you're willing to believe in, all right? Because this is not about what you're willing to believe in. This is about what are you willing to do. Are you just willing to get on your knees in the morning and ask God for the strength to stay clean and sober? And don't ask him for anything else. He doesn't need you to tell him what to do. He's God and you're not. You don't have to believe it. But can you do it and just try to be sincere? Can you do that? I said, yeah, I can do that. You see, I finally had gotten some willingness. I can do that, I said. Thank him at night. Come to meeting every day. Let's start reading the book. Start working on these steps. Let's start going after it. You know, I picked up a drink when I was 13 years old. I found a bottle of wine in the woods that some other kid had stolen and stashed there. I'm from Illinois. It was cold in February, 10 below maybe. The wine had ice chips in it. It was starting to freeze. Big bottle of Chianti, Dago Red, we call it where I come from. Glass with the straw around it, you know. And I thought, some other kid will see me. I want to feel this, what it's like to get drunk. And I sucked that whole bottle of wine down. I can remember the ice chips melting in my throat and how it warmed me up and it took all those feelings away. And how I thought about that. How I thought about that all those years, 13 to 31, 32, I always was thinking, all the years around AA, when's the next time going to be? Where am I going to get it from? Who am I going to do it with? What's it going to feel like? The thinking about it is the obsession. And now I'm staying sober, but I still have this obsession. I still have it. Like I said, I'm a union laborer. 50 years I've been in the laborers' union. Back in them days, I was working in the field. I was working up in Palm Beach, underneath a building, digging ditches for the plumbers. And I came out from under the building, and I went down the street to the 7-Eleven to get a sandwich and a soda and for lunch. And I walked out of there, and I looked to my right, and there were two other construction workers sitting in a car, and they had quarts of beer between their legs, cold quart of beer. And the Frisbee turned up, cleaning the seeds, rolling a reefer, and my eyes glued on that stuff. And as I walked back down the street, the thoughts, I started thinking, them guys are getting high. They're getting high. I got up underneath that building in the dark by myself, and I sat down the side of that ditch, you know, and a thought came to me. I can't remember. I can't remember when the last time was I thought about it. And I started to cry. Chills came all over me. And I realized something. You know what I realized? I realized God loved me. See, I didn't think God loved me. I didn't think God would do anything for me. Not the God I had. I had the wrong God. The God I had didn't meet my demands. Yeah, I'm that guy in the literature. I'm that guy, the belligerent guy. The guy who is mad with God because he won't meet my demands. He doesn't do things my way. How many times I used that, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, to talk myself into going right back out that door. Where's my job that pays a lot of money? Where's my good-looking girlfriend? Where's my nice car to drive in? Where's my nice apartment to live in? This God, you're telling me, a loving God? No, he's no loving God. Why, all he does is punish a bunch of good people and reward a bunch of people that don't deserve it? See, I judged God my way. God didn't meet my demands. He didn't do things the way that I thought he ought to do them. And now here I am sitting in this ditch, and it comes to me that I can't remember when the last time was that I thought about it. And I realized just how powerful this God was who I asked to help me, that I didn't even believe was going to help me, because he reached in and he took something from me. And he was so smooth in doing it, I didn't even know it was gone. I couldn't even remember when the last time was that I thought about something that I had been thinking about day in and day out for years was gone. And all I could think was, this God loves me. He really does love me. He really does want to help me. You know, everything seems to, it seems like whenever something like this happens, which we know are spiritual experiences. I've had many spiritual experiences. Now, that's not the same as a spiritual awakening. We'll get to that down the road. But all of a sudden, you start seeing things. You start hearing things. Things that you didn't see and you didn't hear before. And it just so happens I go to a meeting that night, and the meeting is about prayer. And this man, his name was Ed McGarg. He's been dead a long time. He worked at the Beachcomber, and he was a great guy. He looked like the gnome, you know, a little fat guy with thick glasses and a goatee, you know, like he was some kind of crazy psychiatrist or something. He once sauntered up to me in the Central House, and he whispered in my ear, and, you know, he was sober 35 years. I was just a snot-nosed punk. And he says in my ear, you want to know what the secret of AA is, Tom? And I says, Ed, you know, I thought he was going to lay it on me. And he said, the secret is there is no secret. And he turned and walked away. So what the hell is that? There's no secret. He was sharing. And he said something that changed my life. He said, you know, prayer doesn't change things. Prayer changes people. People change things. And man, that hit me like somebody hit me with a 2x4. Because you see, the problem with me was I've been looking at God to change things for me. You don't change things for me. How come you don't change things for me? What do you got against me? Now I realized something. God had changed me. He'd changed me. He'd taken the obsession for me to drink and to use away. He changed me, and I was the guy who was changing things because of the willingness I had to do what I was told to do. As he used to say, are you willing to go to any lengths? That federal highway was right out the door from Central House. Are you willing to go out there and stand on your head in the middle of federal highway if I tell you to? Are you willing to do that? Because I don't got time for you if you're not willing. You know what I want you to do, Tom? I want you to start wearing your watch on the other wrist. Well, that's ridiculous. Why should I do that? Are you willing? Are you willing to wear your watch on the other wrist? Well, okay, if you say so, you know, if that's what I got to do is put my watch on the... What's to teach you that there's a different way? You don't have to do everything the same way all the time, okay? you got to get used to doing things differently. You know? And, you know, I picked up, I always say that I found my God. I found my God the next morning from that night. Now, I'll tell you, you know, I had been staying sober, going to meetings, working, reading literature, reading the book, reading the 12 and 12. You know, we'd go to meetings where we'd sit and read the book, and the big book, and we'd sit and read the 12 and 12. And this, the 24-hour-a-day book was given to me. I've been reading that for 41 years now, more than 41 years. We didn't have a AA book in those days. We had a 24-hour-a-day book. And this was December the 17th. Now, I told you, I got sober, went to VA on December the 9th. That was more than a year. This is more than a year later when this happens to me. I pick up the 24-hour-a-day book that morning, and it starts talking about, you know, the guy who wrote it was an Oxford Group guy, and he will write things out of the Bible and put it in quotations. And in quotations, it said he maketh the sun to rise on the just and the unjust. He lets the rain fall on the good and the evil. That God makes no distinction between good people or bad people. Sickness or death can strike anyone, anywhere, anytime. Doesn't interfere with the natural laws. My God is not of this world. He doesn't interfere with the nature of this world. We think that we're going to try and figure God out. I was working with a kid, and he told me, he said, you know, I don't think I could do this third step. And I said, well, why is that? What's your problem with it? And he said, well, I don't understand God. And I said, well, that's God as you understood him. And he looked confused, and he said, well, what's that supposed to mean? I said, well, that means exactly what it is. It's God as you understood him, but you don't understand God. I don't understand God either. I'm not meant to understand God. That's not what I'm meant to do. I'm meant to be willing. I used to think that maybe God had some special will just for me. Okay? I'm making a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. So God must have some special will just for me. You know, that he's gonna lay it on me someday. And you know, after several years of sobriety, I finally figured it out. God, that's arrogant as hell. That is really arrogant. For me to think that out of the billions of lives there are, that God has some special will just for me. And I realized something. God's will for me is the same as it is for everybody. I was talking to another man in AA. He said, yeah, look on page 138. It's right there at the top. God's will for us to be happy, joyous, and free. God's will for me is the same as it is for everybody. To be happy, joyous, and free. And God has a plan for me. We used to have a man in our home group. We started our home group with another man. They're both dead now. And he used to say, you know, there's only three laws that you got to obey. You only have to obey three laws. You have to obey the laws of man, or you're going to the penitentiary. And you have to obey the laws of nature, or you're going to get sick and die. And you better obey the laws of God, or you're going to live a stinking, miserable life right here and right now. This is the way that I have been spiritually in this program for all these years. For me, this is not about the hereafter. This is about the here and now. You don't want to be miserable? It's easy to not be miserable. I was meant to be happy. I'm meant to be happy, joyous, and free. All I have to do, you know, is just make a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God and follow the plan. They told me, they said, you know, they told me this when I was a snot-nosed punk in AA, the man who brought me to God. First of all, he told me he was a man who followed a faith. He told me, he said, you know what, Tom, he was a tough man. He come from a tough place, a hard place. He said, you think you're a tough guy, don't you, Tom? I said, yeah, I can handle myself. He said, I'll tell you who a tough guy was. Jesus Christ was a tough guy. He took everything that they threw at him, and he loved them anyway. Are you tough enough for that? Are you tough enough for that? To love them anyway? I would go to him with men that I wanted to murder. I'd be so full of hate and resentment that I want to murder some man. And by the time I was done with him, we'd be on our knees and I'd be in tears asking for forgiveness. I'd go to prisons with him. Before we'd leave, we'd have hardened criminals on their knees, all of us, in prayer. He was special. And he knew how to talk to me. He said, you're nothing but a snot-nosed punk. You got to learn to grow up. You got to learn to love other people. That's not easy to do. Because, you see... I'll tell you the kind of person I am, you know. They wrote my story in this book. Did you know that? Did you know they wrote my story in here? Huh? We go over here. I mean, I remember the first time that they gave me this book, okay, many, many years ago. And I started reading it, you know, and I got to this place. In this book, where you get to on page 62, and it starts in the first full paragraph, and it says, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of all our troubles, driven by 100, and that's as far as I went through the book across the room. And I said, that's a bunch of crap. It's not my fault. It's your fault. The nun's fault. It's the Christian brother's fault. It's the army's fault who threw me out for being a heroin addict. It's everybody who ever bullied me my whole life. It's your fault. It's somebody else's fault. It can't be my fault. And I'm not selfish. It took me years to pick it back up again. But when I did, when I finally got to it, you know, and it started talking about after you read the ABCs, and I always love that, you know, that good, you know, that I'm an alcoholic, can't manage my own life, and probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, that God could and would if he were sought. And then there's next two words are two of the most important words in this book, being convinced. Are you convinced of those three proposals? Because if you're not convinced of those three proposals, you know, I don't know. I've got a good friend. Some of these guys know him, named Pacer Bob. He once said, I heard him say it. He said, you know, the first two steps are a feeling. They're a feeling. You feel it in your heart. And I knew what he meant when he said that. Because there's something that has to be experienced. You have to be experienced at it. You have to have had the experience of surrender and the willingness to come to believe in a power greater than yourself. That God could and would if he were sought. Doesn't say could and would if he were found. But if I seek him, and I'm a seeker. It talks about me, you know. I'm this guy right here on the next page, you know, where it talks about the guy. He's if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. And trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. Whatever will work. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have buried traits. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? That's me. That's my story. When I was told, you're a snot-nosed punk, you don't know how to live right. I said, what do you mean I don't know how to live right? He said, all your life you've been looking to try to fix the inside of you. You know what my sponsor's fond of saying? When the interior's inferior, we fix up the exterior. That's what we do. Let's look good. Let's go to the gym. Let's get sober. Buy a fancy new car. Let's get a good-looking gal. Let's get a good-looking guy. You know, I saw a funny cartoon the other day with Jack Nicholson from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and it said, if you're sitting at the AA table with the cool people, that's like having a seat in an insane asylum. Right? You think that's cool? Let's be popular. All right? And all you've done your whole life is just try to shove everything in this hole that you have in you, this big hole in your soul, everything on the outside of yourself, thinking that you can fill this hole. And has it ever been filled? Nah. It can't be filled, but it can be healed. It can be healed, and God makes that possible. God will make that possible. I promise you. I know that this relationship I have with God is a way of life. I love this. This is from Bob Anderson's book. I'll close with this, A Mind-Powered Disease. This relationship is a way of life, no matter where I am, whether I'm going into surgery, whether I'm looking at my wife laying in a casket. He lost his wife. Or whether I'm just plain happy, I can pray. Otherwise, prayer becomes something you do for a reason. It's not a way of life. The God consciousness that I must have in my life starts in step 3. God consciousness is about practicing God's presence, not my presence. It's talking to something other than myself. This character building comes from applying these steps. It doesn't come from attending a lot of meetings or from reading a lot. This character building is a total application for a new way of life in the day I'm in, always in the day I'm in. I can't draw from yesterday's happiness or yesterday's success, whether it's the middle of the day, the beginning of the day, or the end of the day. My disease needs to be treated now, because that's when I need help. These steps grow. They grow deep, deep, deep. Life out there keeps changing. Situations change. There are many variables all the time. So I have to build a character that can do the right thing for one event today and the next day and for the rest of my life, as long as my heart's beating, this program of recovery is guaranteed by God. Thanks for letting me share.
Let's all thank Tom again. We have tonight's session and all our past speakers podcasted for free at alcoholicsandgod.org. Again, I'd like to invite everybody to our Monday night big book study in this room at 7:15. Those who wish to thank tonight's speaker, please line up down the center aisle. And let's close with the Lord's Prayer seated. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
Heart is heavy, soul is thirsty, body's aching. I am desperately in need of restoration. I'm
stronger man. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet again. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby. Yes, when you're laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. Stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby, and I hope.
everywhere I go. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, 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 let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, 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 let it shine. All in my house, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my house, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my house, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, 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 let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, 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 let it shine.
Michael Chase, here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go.
The fog is lifted. See the light. Count blessings when I go to sleep at night and I dream now. Yeah, I dream now. And everything's alright.
Oh, man. Going on 10 years old, that song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.
One, don't you?
Just wanna set me free. Well, clap your hands if you believe me, champ.